kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode number 81, which I say correctly this time.
Take three. Excellent. Well done, Ty.
Thank you very much. So that is, I'm Ty Barnes, and this is...
Doug Belshaw. How are you this evening?
Well, quite clearly a little flustered.
Yes.
actually, I'm not very well. So is the truth of it. I have heinous sinusitis, which is causing me pain in the frontal area of my head and my ears and things, and been to the doctors, and I've had norovirus.
The norovirus?
Yeah, so we have that in our school. It's a thing.
No. For those of people listening who don't know what that is, do you want to explain?
It's just a sort of spontaneous and unsolicited evacuation of all one's digestive tracts, basically. So lots of our children have had it in the boarding houses, in four boarding houses that share the same kitchen, coincidentally, although we're not sure that's how it passed, that it was a food thing. So we've had, this massive food hygiene will come in, and it's all very, very thoroughly checked out. But so anyway, loads and loads of children. So like something like 50, 60 children were down with it. And I just felt, so last weekend, not the one just gone, the one before, was field weekend, which is like a team building thing for our year nines.
Yeah.
And, so I had to organize this bonkers weekend of kata canoeing, which is two canoes bound together with a couple of steel bars, and that has a net in the middle. And you go in, and so 24, 13, 14 year olds had to row up the River Neen for 5 miles, 10 miles, 12 miles, camp out for the night, and then row back the next day. And I joined them on the Sunday to row back, and I had to organize it all. So hiring vehicles and booking and doing all the risk assessments. What a nightmare. that's all I'm going to say. I don't want to do that again in a hurry. So in the morning, I was due to row. So I was up early. I had to be down at the campsite by sort of 7:30 with breakfast. And, I went to the loo. It's like,
don't spell us the details.
Well, it was a bit like that. And then my stomach was really cramping. I wasn't sick. And I thought, and I had to go on a boat for 7 hours. Like, this isn't going to end well. Mm. And there's no way to stop and go to the loo and stuff. So it was really, really embarrassing and difficult. Anyway, it turned out, so I was just really uncomfortable for the day. But I wasn't ill whilst out rowing, which was good. But I just have my energy completely depleted, and it's felt like my immune system has gone to pot, and so I've had no energy. I've tried to sleep a lot more. It's been really difficult, really hard. Work's been mounting up and mounting up, and I've got all the coursework, the controlled assessments being assessed and going in. So it's been really a lot, feeling like a lot of pressure.
So you decided to come and talk to me for a couple of hours. Excellent.
Well, that's it, because I've got loads of time on my hands. So. So I thought.
Well, I definitely understand the lack of sleep thing. So, for a couple of reasons, I tried to do. I've just been in Canada. So last time we spoke for the podcast was 2 weeks ago when I was in Toronto, and from there I went to Calgary, and I tried to stay. So there's 2 hour time difference between Mountain Time, which is Calgary, and Eastern Daylight Time, which is Toronto. And I tried to stay on Toronto time zone by going to bed early when I was in Calgary and getting up early, and that went really well. And then, like we said last time, I tried to eat for the time zone I was going into and do all that kind of stuff. And it was all going really well until my family very kindly didn't wake me up on the Friday morning after I got back. And I slept till midday, which just completely shafted my body clock.
Oh, wow, yes.
So all weekend, I've just been getting up in the middle of the night and wandering around and doing stuff. And in fact, on Saturday morning, I was doing my Thought Trapple newsletter at 3 a.m.,
Wowee. Well, that's exactly it, isn't it? You never know whether to get up and get on or try to push for some more sleep and just lie there like an idiot.
And then the other interesting thing is that, nowhere where I was in Canada affected my hay fever. So I wasn't taking tablets and everything was fine. And then I come back here and it's like, oh, my days. Because although I live in a town, it's very much surrounded by loads and loads of very mature trees and things. So that's been interesting. And the thing I don't think I mentioned on the podcast last time was that I think just before we recorded, I got the news that my grandma had died. And Yeah, so I was still processing all that while I was away, and I ended up writing a blog post just called, you know, Goodbye Grandma. And I got pretty emotional, even though she was 93 and old and, you know, ready to go and all that kind of stuff. But we're recording this on Tuesday, the 9th of May, and her funeral is on Thursday. So that would be just nice to kind of close things off and see family again and do all that kind of stuff. And it'll be the first funeral that my children go to, so yeah, that'll be an interesting experience.
Yeah, no, that will be a difficult thing. And I haven't read the post yet, but I will when I have time to give it its due care and attention.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that was, you know, after reading the post, my dad asked me to like either do or help with the eulogy, and so I ended up, you know, spending a good amount of time with him last Saturday, finding out stuff that I didn't know about my grandma's life that he spoke about. And then, you know, trying to, you know, because he's, you know, he's got a master's and he's fine at writing, but I guess I write all the time. And so I just kind of tidied things up and put things into an outer structure and whatever. But yeah, I'm just reading a psalm and he's doing the eulogy and she's being cremated and stuff. But yeah, it's just an interesting time, I guess, when you have all that kind of emotional roller coaster at the same time. The other thing is, I haven't been on Twitter.
No, you decided to get off it for May, didn't you?
So that's been interesting. It's been different from, you know, when I do the Belshaw Black Ops thing or whatever, because this time it's just Twitter. I'm still on Mastodon, which I'm discovering new people and finding out new ways to do things that I used to do before. So do you use anything like IFTTT to do interesting things with Twitter, like favorites and stuff?
I have done, yeah. I've used it in different ways in the past. I'm not really wedded to anything it does particularly.
Because one thing I found really useful, especially when you're kind of curating things for newsletters and such like, is I've got one IFTTT recipe where, and for those listening, it's just if that, then this. You connect all your services together, and then, for example, if I favorite something on Twitter and the tweet has got a link in, it gets saved automatically to my pinboard favorites or pinboard stream. For bookmarks. And so I wanted something similar, and the only way I could figure out to do it without delving into the developer API and whatever was to get the RSS feed. So every Mastodon user has an RSS feed, but favorites don't show up on there. Only boosted toots do. So a boost is equivalent of a retweet, and a toot is the equivalent of a tweet. So anything that I effectively retweet, if I boost someone's toot, which sounds slightly rude.
lots of O's.
Then that does show up on my RSS feed. And then I've tried to find a way, and it seems to be working, where anything with a link in then goes to my pinboard. So I wrote a post about that. So if you're using Mastodon, have a look at that. I think there's other bots you can use and services and stuff. I've noticed that you haven't used it very much.
So this is to do with my illness, really, and busyness, really. So I spent a week on there and talking to a couple of people and doing a couple of things, tooting a couple of things out and whatever, and it seemed fine, having a look around and just sort of getting used to the new platform. It was fine. I quite like the idea. I tell you, I really like the idea of getting into a new river of conversation. That was that. But Twitter kept pulling me back to specific conversations. So I have private lists on Twitter. Right. And some of them are ones, so I change who's in them. And according to the things that I'm interested in at the moment that are going on in my work, if you see what I mean, but things, people that I know that are doing the same things as me. So that always draws me back in because the conversation's always rich. Interesting things to read and such like. So I've started using Twitter more like that in a way recently, rather than having a big feed. I obviously have my big feed that I follow, and I do.
Right, so you're kind of following a subset.
Yeah, but really small, you know, less than a dozen people in them, and that sort of thing. Really tight.
What I've really appreciated about just an experiment with Mastodon, which, you know, obviously I'll do until the end of the month, is you've got more space I think you've got 500 characters instead of 140, so you can express yourself a lot more clearly and precisely. Of course, you don't have to use 500 characters. And also, the people who I'm following, and I'm pretty indiscriminate in terms of who I'm following, the things they share and the way that they share them seems to be a lot less sensationalist. So I went back onto Twitter because Nick Dennis had mentioned that he mentioned an article about an SHP, so Schools History Project workshop that we ran almost 10 years ago.
Oh, right, okay.
In which someone had, was it Sally? Had said that basically she signed up for Twitter at our workshop, and then the article went on from there about her educational technology journey and stuff. And so I kind of got a notification on that, and I went back and I just went through my stream of people I follow, and I was like, oh my goodness, like, I feel emotional about, like, I'm angry about stuff, whereas when I'm going through things on Mastodon, I feel much more informed. I guess it's because you've got people who are more like you, you know, more people who are more likely to be early adopters, more people who are likely to be, like, libertarian socialists or whatever, you know, like, you've just got...
Well, I think it's, but I also think it's a certain thing. So what it reminded me of a little bit, and I wanted to get into it more, and got broken by whatever my use of it, but or disrupted, should I say? But it's a bit like when we started using Slack, and you had Solidarity going in there, and it was like a few new people, a few that I knew, but a sort of tighter group, you know. It just kind of worked the conversation better, and when you were sharing stuff, you weren't sharing and saying, I found the answer, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. You weren't, as you said, sensationalizing things. You're just kind of saying, this is kind of, saw this, anyone seen this?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Anyone got any thoughts, anyone looking at this, and that kind of thing. You just have it, and it just allows for conversation. And it's a bit like when you go down the pub, you know, if there's someone spouting all the answers, you're kind of like, yeah, whatever.
And
you find somewhere else to have a drink or whatever, you know, and it's a bit like that, I think. So I think Mastodon has legs in that way.
And the fact that it's, I mean, for those who didn't listen to our last podcast, the way that I know I haven't come across Mastodon, it's federated. So you can run your own instance, or you can join someone else's, and they can add new things and change things around or whatever. But the idea is that it's federated, so you can see, you can remotely follow. So we're actually on different instances, aren't we, Di? You're on Mastodon Social.
I am, yeah.
And I'm on Mastodon Cloud, because I'd forgotten that I actually had an account on Mastodon Social. So when I came to sign up and Mastodon Social was closed to new signups, I went to Mastodon Cloud instead. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any difference in practice. But I should imagine as time goes on, there will be. I did read, I'll not put the link in here because it's of, you know, niche interest. But one really interesting, so a couple of things. First of all, the way that people are naming their instances is really interesting. So there's been this explosion in terms of TLDs, top-level domain names. You know, there's .cloud, .social, .town. And so one quite famous one on Mastodon was witches.town, witches town. And that was explicitly, you could do whatever you wanted, but of course it then became full of paedophilia and just, you know, like, awful pornography and just Nazi stuff, and so in the end the guy shut the instance down. But it just goes to show how community rules and guidance kind of plays a, and norms plays a big part in all that kind of stuff.
I think that's absolutely right, isn't it? And I was just thinking when I was talking about Twitter a minute ago, is that, so Twitter is for you what it is for you, and Twitter is for me what it is for me, which aren't the same. And for everyone using Twitter, it's kind of different. It's a different experience because of the conversations that you're having and the people you're connected to, which isn't a constant thing either. That changes over time as well. And so it's not that Twitter, I mean, Twitter, you could argue, has its bad things, you know, shareholder driven, whatever, and that kind of thing, and I think is true. But really, it's all about the conversation, and you can kind of you can see that that's fair play, I think, and it's just about finding that river of conversation that's suiting you at any one time, and having the flexibility to move out is quite powerful, I think.
No, definitely. And someone pointed out that, you know, Diaspora, which we talked about years ago, still has, I think, 17,000 people using it across different instances because you can't shut it down. It's, you know, it's open source software. Another thing which took somebody pointing this out for me to realize is that there's no direct messaging in Mastodon.
Yeah, no, I noticed that because I messaged you about when we didn't do Tide last week. I messaged you on this because I said, oh, he's off Twitter, isn't he? I'll message him on that.
Which I actually quite like. So hilariously, my dad, there's been a lot of backwards and forwards, as you can imagine, with my grandmother's funeral. Yes. And He is now on Twitter because he likes following my tweets and also some golf tweets and things. We're connected on Telegram, and we're also connected just via text. And I think all of the apps that we use are blue in color, so he gets confused between them. So sometimes he sends me Twitter DMs. I'm like, Dad, can we move to like an encrypted channel here? Can we go like move to Telegram? And then he'd be sending me like MMSs when I was in Canada. And I was like, Dad, this is going to cost me a fortune to download. Oh, sorry, I thought I was on Telegram. Like, he just doesn't get the difference between them. And I think for you and I and people who recognize the importance of the difference between all of these different tools, it's actually quite nice for there not to be a DM feature in there because you can then, you choose to then connect with people personally and privately on different in different ways.
In different ways, yeah, and I think that's what it's all about. And it certainly gives you a little sense of liberation and freedom. That's nice.
I see you've
And
just tooted there.
I just have tooted out that we're talking
I'm gonna
about.
boost your toot.
Thank you very much. I'll just
Don't
get
just
my.
boost anyone's toot, you know, Di.
I appreciate that. So I think that's right. You're just talking about your dad, and it reminded me of something similar. My dad turned 78 on the 30th of April, and I bought him a Fitbit Charge 2, I think it is. I think that's the model I got, and sent it up to him. And I did something really good. So I sent it to me in Amazon, sent it to myself first, wrapped it, personalized it, and then sent it up separately. So as I was talking to him on the phone last night, and he's not really savvy with his tech. He has his computer, he does everything. Doesn't like to, he has a mobile phone, but he never takes it out of the house with him. And never uses it in the house. I'm not really sure why he has it, but anyway. So he's not really very tech savvy, and so we were talking about how you're going to set your Fitbit up. And he said, "I've opened it." He says, "But I'm not really sure what to do." So I sent him a video to my mum's Facebook Messenger account. I sent a video for him to watch on her tablet, to do like an unboxing and instructional setup thing to see if he can follow it or if they can follow it between them. And so I'm hoping that he's going to enjoy that. It's going to be the sort of biggest bit of tech that he's ever used.
Well, very good.
So but that was the thing. So this time I kind of said to him, he said, "Look, Rick, my brother could, he lives nearby them. He could come and sort it out and show him what to do, or I could when I go up and see them next." But I said it'd be better if you did it because then you'd actually understand more about the tech,
Yeah, definitely.
and you'd and therefore more likely to get something out of the device and that's useful. So. That's cool. Let me
Cool. Well,
see how.
talking about that kind of stuff, did you see that Amazon have launched the new version of the Amazon Echo Play Music?
Here's a station you might like. Take that.
I nearly got you.
No, you got it. You did it.
Yay!
I think we're going to have some take that.
Is that
You
what
ready,
the that's
everyone?
what you're playing?
Did you musical interlude? I think that's enough.
Standing
Echo, stop. Right, that's that done. So Doug just triggered my Alexa. That's not called Alexa. Right. So yes. So Echo released a new thing. I saw a tweet coming out. Something to do with a screen. Tell me more.
Yes, so this new version of it is basically that Amazon device, which we can't mention the name of in case it triggers it, and it appends the word show on the end. And the idea is that it's got a small 7-inch screen, something like that, with speakers built in. So same deal. So as well as the massively, sensitive microphone and speakers, it's also got a screen and a camera as well. So as Motherboard, the website Motherboard said, Amazon basically made the telescreen from 1984.
Yeah, you could say they did that, right? But depending on the quality of the screen and what you can do with it, what they basically made is a small tablet computer, and that you could take anywhere with you, unless it has to be plugged in. I'm not sure,
No, I think it has to be plugged in. I mean,
but it's
as we've talked about
anchored to the home,
before.
so it sort of makes sense, and it sort of doesn't. It is the ultimate surveillance device, though, to be fair.
It is, because they can listen to all the things and see them as well. So what have I got in my dining room? Well, I had a MSI version of this before. I've got a Dell touchscreen PC. It's 24 inch, I think, and it's running Elementary OS, which is a Linux distribution. And it's one of the few devices that I've ever owned that has ever had like a shutter built into the webcam. So you can close it off when you're not using it. Well, of course, with that particular machine, we'd hardly ever use the webcam because we use our own devices for that. And because it's Linux, I can control all the things and know that it's not kind of feeding information back to the big four evil multinational companies. Oh. So for me, we use that to look things up, to play music, the occasional YouTube video, that kind of thing. And so I really like that. How much that cost me? About 450 quid a few years ago. Whereas this Amazon device, I think it's only coming out in the US first, but it's just over $200, isn't it? So maybe about, between 200 and 250 quid for us.
No, less. Oh, yeah, it might be. Dollars and quids, they're just the same now these days, more or less.
Pretty much, yeah. I was actually shocked when I went to Canada. Last time I went to Canada, which was only a couple of years ago, I was getting $3 to the pound, and now, probably because of Brexit, I get $1.50. So everything is quite expensive.
Wow, that's expensive. Speaking of computers, I bought a computer on Sunday, sort of new computer. So I currently run about 4 or 5 devices.
Mm-hmm. What is it, like a Windows 10 thing?
No, it's not, as you well know.
You mean we were talking about this before? Sorry, I was trying to just build up the...
I know you were. It's all fun. So I run a Chromebook, an iPad, an Android phone, a MacBook Pro, Raspberry Pi, and that's it. That's the devices I have. But I also, a lot of devices pass through my hands, so I have them for a month and they move on to other people.
You like a fence?
Yeah, that kind of thing. And so I kind of thought, I don't have a computer anymore. I have 2 computers sitting in the garage which I don't use anymore. They're old and I could rejuvenate them, but they're noisy and big and whatever. So I went online and had a look for something that I could get, and I thought, I want a powerful machine that is my kind of go-to machine, go on my standing desk, and just be the thing that I want to use, the computer I want to use to do things, you know. But not a mobile device, just one that sits on my desk. And so I ended up having a look at a few reviews of different things. Came across the Nook, the NUC, which is like a bare bones little mini computer.
Oh, and that stands for next unit of computing, doesn't it? It's an Intel thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's an Intel Nook. And so I started looking down that line, went down the rabbit holes that you need to go down, kind of thing. And I thought, I don't really, the idea of getting a new shiny computer, Windows 10 on it, kind of filled me full of dread. And I didn't really want to stay in the MacBook world. My MacBook Pro is provided by the school, so it's not really my computer. And I kind of wanted something that was mine, to take ownership, so the software on it is what I want exactly and all that kind of thing. So I ended up, I watched this review of this guy who had this silent running PC. So it's a fanless little box. And he bought it and he went through setting it up and how he'd set it up. And he was very, very detailed all about the BIOS and other stuff. And it was really, really interesting. So I went onto the site that he recommended, which was a company called eGlobal, I think, which were selling on AliExpress, which is Alibaba, sort of China's equivalent of eBay.
Oh, and that huge thing that Yahoo's got a stake in or used to.
Yeah, it's a massive, massive thing. So if you're in China, it's where you shop online kind of thing. And so I went on there and then eventually found a machine, ordered one. They didn't have it anymore, ordered another one. So it's really, it's powerful. It's running 32 gig of RAM and DDR4 and a 500 gigabyte SSD and an i7-7500MU processor. Which is big and chunky. So, but the actual thing is about the size of a couple of cigarette boxes, more or less.
Wow.
So I can just unclip it from everything and take it with me should I wish to. So I thought, okay, that kind of makes sense for me. So I bought it, but it's sort of interesting to people listening maybe is if you're going to shop on Alibaba, you actually need to prove who you are beforehand. So I partnered with my cash. It cost me 650 GBP, and I partnered with my cash, and then got a message about 6 hours later that said your order is closed due to security reasons. And I was like, what? And that was
so. What options? Just out of interest, what options did you have for paying? I guess you use your credit card, yeah.
Yes, I did.
And so what other did they take, like, Bitcoin, any cryptocurrencies?
I didn't see anything like that. It's not okay. Wacky. I didn't check though, because I don't have any Bitcoin. So
okay.
And So I roll, yeah, and so I thought, first of all, I thought, scam. I ran around the internet looking for other people in a similar situation and kind of got the idea that some people have been a bit pissed off with it, but at the end of the day, money had been returned, although it took about 30-odd days to do it.
Right.
So I sort of thought about the processes that they were going through, and what they're really trying to do is internationally prove that you're the holder of the card, because they can't guarantee that, and they you know, potentially subject to a lot of scams. It's a very different country with over 10 times the amount of people in it than there are in our country. Mm. So they must be very wary of international scamming, especially in tech-related equipment, where people are likely possibly to have some tech-savvy stuff going on. And so I think that's what they're doing. So I uploaded my details. I took a leap of faith, which is probably a mistake, uploaded my details, and which included a picture of my driving license. And
now there's somebody walking through Heathrow called Ty Barnes.
Yeah, that's it, driving my car, apparently. So we'll see if hopefully – so that's an appeal. I had to put an appeal, and that appeal will hopefully work. It's in process at the moment. It says on their website. And the appeal will work, and they'll authorize me as a buyer. And then it will take about 2 weeks after that for my device to arrive. So I'm quite excited about that. And that's going to have Linux installed on it. So I've got one that's Ubuntu compatible. And I've asked for Ubuntu to be installed rather than Win 10, because I just run an OEM copy of Win 10, which isn't genuine.
Right.
And I didn't want that anyway. So, but I think I'll probably just clean it when I get it, so to make sure there's nothing on there but what I want.
Mm.
And do an install and run Linux on it. So I'm going to go with a big, powerful device running Linux and set it up in the way that I want and sort of, yeah. And
do that. Well, I've just put a link in for NUC, Next Unit of Computing, for those interested. Looks pretty cool. So the way they bought that is interesting. And the way that we as a society want money to be trackable and linked to identity is interesting as well. So having gone through quite a few airports recently, as you know, if you're carrying more than $10,000, £10,000, £10,000, whatever,
uh-huh.
you have to declare it. And also, I don't know if you've ever been left in PayPal limbo hell before. Have you been in PayPal purgatory?
No, not properly.
So this has happened a few times to me. So I've been using PayPal for, well, ever since it started, about 16, 17 years. And I can remember it just sometimes, if you press the wrong buttons in the wrong order. For example, the co-op, because I was entirely honest about the way that we're structured and the fact that laws in Germany and all this kind of stuff, we had to prove all these things, then we didn't, then we did again, and then we had money in the account which we couldn't take out. And I was reading, actually, this week of somebody who had set up their PayPal account. It was on Hacker News. They'd set up their PayPal account before they were 18 because they were a coder and they'd sold something or whatever. Anyway, they'd gone into some difficulties or PayPal had investigated, and because they'd set up their PayPal account before they were 18, and they shouldn't have done because apparently you can't have one, or at that point you shouldn't have had one. Mm. Basically, PayPal said that we've shut your account, there is no way you can log into it, and you cannot get the money. And they were just like, these are our agreements, and you've gone past them, like you've flouted them, and there's nothing you can do, bye-bye. And yeah, and so for me, things like Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, if you imagine your transaction, if you'd used Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever, they wouldn't have had to do any of the identity checking.
Oh, I see, yes, indeed.
Yeah? Which is actually more secure for you.
Mm.
Yeah,
I was talking about blockchain the other day, so I asked my lower six class, who are 16, 17, to investigate blockchain, because we've been looking at networking methodologies, and so we're talking about peer-to-peer, and the conversation just went on, so I sent them a homework to sort of find out what they thought would be good uses for blockchain, to help them understand it, and then we spent a lesson looking through a couple of videos and talking about it, and where did we get to? And one of the things that I thought during that lesson, during our conversations, was about identity, is that, you know, people are looking to verify digital identity, and blockchain, you know, for good or for bad, would actually be an efficient way of doing that.
Definitely, yeah.
What would go wrong with that? I'm not sure that we would know when we set it up. Do you know what I mean? And potentially lots of stuff.
Some scary stuff. Yeah, so I know that this is supposed to be an education-related podcast, but it seems like a lot of the stuff that's going around, especially post-Brexit, post-French election, in the run-up to potential nuclear conflict between the US and North Korea, the South Korean elections, all that kind of stuff, there does seem to be a general sense of unease, and certainly in the networks that I'm part of, around the level of surveillance which we have in our culture. I know we've talked about this a lot, and for some people listening, it might be like, oh my goodness, Diane, are we going to talk about this again? But just to make people aware of some of the stuff that's going on, I don't know where to start, really. Maybe the smart city stuff?
Yeah, let's have a look at that. I've not seen that stuff, so it'd be interesting.
Okay, so there's a couple of things here. Let's move them to the top. So NVIDIA, a company I absolutely love, mainly because they make the NVIDIA Shield, which is just the NVIDIA Shield TV, which I have in my lounge, and it runs Android, and it's just a beautiful, extremely powerful box that does all the things I want to do, and I can sideload apps, and I can download things on BitTorrent and just throw them on there, and all this kind of stuff. NVIDIA have extremely powerful GPUs, graphics processing units, which are so fast these days that they're kind of supplanting CPUs, you know, central processing units. Yeah. And also they're developing all kinds of artificial intelligence and cloud platforms and everything. And as the headline says on this new Atlas post, it says NVIDIA's slightly terrifying Metropolis platform paves the way for smarter cities. Now, interestingly, I've just taken my kids to piano lessons, and obviously one goes at a time. And so my son, who's 10, I showed him the video, and I said, what do you think of that? And of course his first response is, that's really cool. And I was like, well, can you think of any concerns? Because I also showed him the new Amazon device. And then he knows me well enough to go, oh, I see what you mean. Like, not only are there cameras everywhere, but there's... you're listening to it. You know, these things can track you. They can do object recognition. They can track you across the city. And some of the, it's a bit like any kind of promotional video. Some of the scenarios they say it should help with, like, you've lost your dog. We'll find it really easily across the city. Are just like, so what? I've got no civil liberties left. You know what I mean? Like, who cares?
I think there is going to be, there are going to be issues about that, and it's just going to dictate where you live and what you know, where you choose to live and that kind of thing. Should you have a choice? I think, if you are, what was it I saw a sign for? I think 42 megacities there are in the world. Mm. Which I was in Bangkok, it's one of them.
Yeah.
And reading sort of interesting things about that. And I lived in London for 20 years and have a sort of sense of London. I don't know in its entirety and don't care for it much. And I think there is going to be a big deal about that. So I know, for example, where I live in lovely Oundle, there is very, very little CCTV. It's very little cause for it. And there is actually very little as well. Whereas I know when I lived in London, I was thankful for CCTV because it gave me a layer of protection when I was out on my Todd or my children were out and about in town in the dark. And that kind of thing. So I wasn't as against it as I might be. And even though I grew up myself out and about and in towns and whatever, and there was no CCTV that I was aware of. But this is just frightening.
Yeah, it's just like connecting everything together. And I put another article in there because this is actually from December 2016, but it was shared, in various places this week. And it's a guy who's all for smart cities, obviously, because there's a lot of money in smart cities in terms of the tech behind it and the data and stuff. And he's saying that the three perks of a cohesive smart city are sustainability, like you can save energy and water and all that kind of stuff, which is great. Two, and he calls this community. He talks about autonomous smart bus networks like in Finland. He talks about... Wi-Fi, pollution levels, that kind of stuff. That's not really community, so that's an interesting thing. And then three, growth. Talks about how when everything's working as it should do, you can save money and you can grow and everything like that. And I just feel like that's not necessarily what I would want from my environment. And when you go back to the new Atlas post, the person there with it, saying that this is a terrifying thing, says, quote, It's an opportunity to make all kinds of things run better. Knowing capitalism, it'll probably also result in supermarket layouts that route you past the maximum number of impulse purchase snack displays and become part of the face detection personal advertising onslaught we've been expecting for decades now. End of quote.
I'd say, right, so I noticed, so we have new buildings built here and we do it with big budgets kind of thing. I don't want to suggest they're crazy, but they're small. And so they have like automated lights, for example, but everything is done within the room. The sensors are built within the room and that kind of thing. But obviously, wherever you see something that's automated, you start thinking, oh, OK, that could easily be connected to the Internet.
Yeah.
And I run Amazon's virtual digital assistant at home. I have lights that turn on as I walk past them in my house, so I don't have to turn light switches on and off, which is not the same thing, obviously, by a long way. And it's quite interesting how you can set technology up to work for you but still look after you kind of thing, and how you can set technology up so the only way it works is to be like the Amazon thing, like the VDA, is to be pervasive into your life kind of thing, you know. So I trust the fact that Amazon aren't collecting every word I say, but I also live alone. So the number of conversations that I have that are private are often as much down a device like this conversation, which isn't private, obviously, as they are, so it's into a phone or it's whatever. So I don't worry about it too much. But if I was living with my family, I wouldn't necessarily want my four walls exposed to the world.
No, exactly.
I want a level of privacy, and also a level of psychological privacy, which I can manage in my own mind. But if I live with other people who didn't understand technology in the same way, I wouldn't want to subject them to that. So there's lots of different things like that. However, smart cities, but you can see how, like, they talk about buildings becoming more intelligent. So he says here something about smart windows alone can save up to 26% on cooling and 67% on lighting costs. So smart buildings are coming in already.
And that's great, but I don't see why that should be tied to facial recognition and following people around the city and all that kind of stuff.
But it will be. I mean, and that's the thing. And so the smart city thing, you know, this talk at the moment about universal income. So the universal income, for those that aren't sure, is where people get paid a basic amount of money without having to work for it because they are in society and society doesn't have enough jobs to provide for its citizens. So if that comes in, it will come in, but this is going to be the payoff. There's still a payoff between what's going to be termed, and hasn't yet been termed, but termed glorified welfare or something, or welfare on steroids or whatever. And the balance between that is because a lot of taxpayers' money is going to pay for this smart city stuff, and therefore that's going to be, you know, this stuff is going to be brought in. So if you are a non-working person receiving universal income, and then... you know, you'll have a chip in you to track your...
you won't need chip because it's just facial recognition.
Well, just facial, yeah, and all of that. And this stuff is becoming much, much better. Mm. But what you think about these things, these devices, like the lights in the buildings that we build, so we have a key fob that gets, you know, only the people whose key fob works. And at the moment, it's just a key fob. But, you know, at some point, that's just going to be... You have to touch it to a pad, but at some point, that's going to change and the key fob will have a signal. You know, there'll be Wi-Fi coming off it, and it will, and as you walk towards the door, it will open because it knows that you're coming. Things like that. And it will just... Whatever way it does it, it will, you know, it'll improve and get more so. And then I'm just sort of thinking back to the conversation I had with my friend Logan Evans when I was in Mountain View. And and he's working for Google. He's working on the ability to alter a chipset to use a chipped architecture to change that and upgrade it or update it whilst it's in situ. And that is going to be what happens, is that you're going to get these mega chips with lots of sensors, like your mobile phone has this massive range of sensors. And so it can just go around detecting all sorts of nonsense and be used for different purposes.
The thing that gets me is the lack of privacy. So you mentioned the word kind of psychological safety or there's something about, as we discussed before, knowing that you're not being seen or tracked, yeah, which allows you to relax and be yourself and not be kind of donning a mask, however, you know, it allows you to develop as a person. Yeah. So some of the stuff which we've put in here, which you don't need to go into depth about, there's an article in Science magazine that talks about stray Wi-Fi signals could let spies see inside closed rooms. You know, the fact that there's so many different Wi-Fi networks is effectively triangulating with the things bouncing off you. It can almost create, like on the end of Batman, The Dark Knight, where you can see from all the mobile phones like a holographic projection. Yeah.
How do you trace the Invisible Man? You spray a fire extinguisher and you can see his space kind of thing. So he becomes... You see the air around him. it's that principle, isn't it?
Yeah. And
so what's the ultrasonics? Is there also links in here about ultrasonics?
Yeah, so the ultrasonic thing is different. So ultrasonic beacons are, I think it's Android at the moment, but there's about 230 apps according to this academic article, which is cited in a couple of places, one on ZDNet and one on Bruce Schneier's blog, Schneier on Security. And what this does is The 230 apps have background processors running which are listening for these ultrasonic sounds. So sounds that your ears can't hear but can be picked up by the phone. And when you're watching TV, there are programs, adverts, whatever, which are sending out ultrasonic signals, unbeknownst to you, which can then be picked up by your phone. And then it means that that television and your phone are now linked together as being yours.
Yes. That kind of happens now. So if you do you use Chromecast or anything of the sort?
I've got Chromecast built into the Shield, yeah.
So what happens for me anyway, no matter what device I am looking at, I'm watching a YouTube video on, it will, because it's on my Wi-Fi network, I think, it gets picked up and I can control that device off my phone.
Right.
And so whether it's on my telly or another computer or something like that, my phone will offer me controls on the notification panel or controls to that video or something. It's a bit weird. It sort of feeds itself in the background to something that presents itself to me as, it seems like when you get it, it's like, oh, that's quite convenient. That's quite nice. Mm. But actually there's communication going on that I've never authorized. And it's quite interesting. So I think...
Yeah, it's the same with like today... On the Shield, I'd signed out of my Spotify account while I went away because I didn't want my kids playing like rubbish music, which would then affect my recommendations on Spotify because I'm precious like that. Well, I've spent 8 years on Spotify, Di, and you know it was getting to the stage. So I've got a Spotify family account, and okay, call me precious, but I don't care. Anyway, I had to sign back in.
The Lord forgive that you might get something you didn't expect.
Exactly.
There's nothing to do with your tastes.
Well, anyway, so I was signing back into Spotify, and instead of having to put in my username or password, I just had to basically pick up my phone, go to Spotify, it said devices available, and then I just pressed the button to then send the sound to the TV, and then it knew that those two devices were linked together. Well, that's something that I'm choosing to do, but I'm sure there's lots of times when the fact that two devices, which are just two IP addresses on the internet, as far as people are concerned, are now being linked together as being yours. And of course, that means they can track data across what you do and your habits and all that kind of stuff. So it's all to do with data gathering. When people like you and I who care about this stuff are surprised by new and innovative ways that people are tracking you, you just wonder for people like our parents that we've talked about before, or people who are just like, oh, I use Facebook without any kind of ad blockers or anything, just thinking, okay, right, this is how we end up with we'll come to this later, I guess, in terms of what's been termed the Great Brexit Robbery and how our democracy was hijacked. We'll come to that later, but it's no wonder we end up with something like that.
Do you know what is quite interesting? The strength of the human being to resist. So if you think about why they're collecting all this stuff, right, all this information about us, about each individual, they're doing it as direct advertising it as so that we will part with our cash and become in some way brand faithful. And I'm quite pleased with the fact that that doesn't work on me because I just don't spend my money.
Yeah.
Basically, I spend my money on a very set number of things, like the computer that I bought. It's not influenced by anything that I do on a computer, if you see what I mean. Sorry, anything I do on the internet or in that world of data access. It's based on what I do for a living, and where I want, what I think will work for me, and all that kind of thing. I guess you could argue that just using the internet is like its own advertisement in itself, and that I want more technology in my life, not less, whereas a lot of people I know are wanting less technology in their lives.
Do you find that you buy more stuff through Amazon now you've got the device, which has previously been mentioned?
No, I don't purchase through that. And no, I don't actually. So I'm always conscious of the fact, because I pay Amazon Prime, I should get free postage. And to the extent, if I had two options and one was to buy Prime and it was, say, £1 more, I would buy the thing with £1 more to get the free postage. It's a little bit insane.
And, no, but it's also the customer service as well, I guess.
Yeah, no, it is completely that. And the speed of the delivery is pretty cool. Mm. And you kind of, once you start getting into that sort of track of, or that trait of behavior, like buying stuff off Amazon Prime, is that you just know it's going to take this long, whereas I've no idea how long other things take, and you don't know whether things are coming from somewhere else in the world, like from America or something like that, and they might take quite a long time. So I found in my experience that to be waiting around for certain products and just thinking, why is it not here? And there are different reasons like that. So you develop these traits of behavior. I don't spend a lot of money on stuff. I don't think it's necessary. So I don't feel that whatever advertising gets shoved down my throat, then it's not a big deal.
Well, linking this back to education, which is a rare thing these days, did you see in the New York Times this article entitled "In China, Daydreaming Students Are Caught on Camera"?
I didn't see this. No, what is this?
So apparently the big thing in China at the moment, you know, the land where copyright doesn't mean anything and privacy is just a distant dream, they have cameras in loads of classrooms. They call it a cultural phenomenon. And it's not just classrooms, it's like restaurants and all this kind of stuff. And people tune in, and hilariously, worryingly, some people sit watching the webcams and then alert the teacher or comment when kids aren't paying attention.
So I'm going to just go with my surface reaction to this. It reminds me of Louis von Ahn and the whole capture-recapture thing and the indexing of Google Images that he did to the early 2000s, where he was talking about human computation, get people to do the thing for you, and somehow, so he realized that there was something like 16 billion working hours per year put into playing solitaire. So if he could capture that that labor, in some way, by making games, then it would be cool. And that's where the Google Index imaging system that he developed came from, and why Google Images are now so very well indexed. So it reminds me of that, is that people would sit at home. It's like a game, you know? It's like that ability to interact with other people and influence another physical space in the world. That I can see why people would do that. Teacher, check the one in the blue jacket.
Exactly. And, you know, interestingly, it talks about a couple of things. It says, reached by telephone, several teachers said they were uncomfortable that anyone with an internet connection could tune into their classroom discussion. So this isn't like a private network. This is like on the internet for anyone to see. Then it says, to avoid the camera's stare, they sometimes congregate in a blind spot near the front of the classroom, they said.
All right, okay. Well, you can see from some of the pictures that's got in the post that that's the case. And there are children in there. And the classrooms look really interesting, to be honest. They're all kind of techie makerspaces, I think, kind of thing they look like. But you'd imagine that would be the case. That's what you'd do. Or you'd hang a hat on it or something.
Let me see if I can find one now.
A live one?
Yeah.
Fair play. The ones they've got some sort of video or GIF of a video or something, which is on the 27th of March.
2016. So one's called Shuidi, Shuidi. And apparently it's the most popular one, and I don't know. I can't find one straight away, but I'm sure it wouldn't take you long to find it. And people, a 17-year-old speaking out saying that they hate it, they feel like they're zoo animals, etc. And if you think about it, like, it's it's a really interesting thing to do from a, even from a child safety point of view. You can imagine paedophiles, like really dangerous people watching the, oh wow, yeah, it's a crazy world.
It is kind of crazy. It's an interesting thing about, and it's like the perverse side of being open. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, there's being open, isn't there? Yeah.
No, I agree. I completely. But the classrooms they've got in here are very techie classrooms. There's computers all over the place, webcams, all sorts of stuff. But being made, lots of wires and children with making things going. Mm. I guess they've just sanitized them for the post. I don't know
about you, but I found certainly in the conferences, you know, there was that. There's certainly with technology, there's always that initial rush of doing stuff because it's possible. And then people kind of sit back and go, oh, right, that's what it leads to. So, for example, can you remember when having a real-time uncensored Twitter wall next to the keynote speaker was a thing?
Yeah, I remember that.
Until it became just terrible, and then people got rid of that. Even live streaming, I feel like, is less of a thing from conferences now. It tends to be more like highlights or like part of the marketing, and like it, instead of it just being a constant feed for some of them.
I was having this discussion today with our head teacher's husband, and he runs a table tennis. They have a big house, as like heads in private schools tend to do, and called Cobthorne, and he has the Cobthorne Cup, and it's a table tennis tournament. So every boarding house and day house participates and puts players forward and goes to a tournament and whatever. And the finals a week tomorrow. And last year we streamed it live out onto the internet, which meant that one of the finalists, their parents could watch over in Asia. But this year he wanted to do a highlights thing. So I was having this discussion with him about the idea of that any digital artifact that you create, we can create anything that you want. You know, we can do a cool highlights video, or we can do a live stream. We probably can't do both because it's a restricted space and you'd have cameras in different places for the highlights. But I said the only thing that really matters is that this gains some traction. You know, I mean, that's the big thing. We can do what you like, but it's what gains traction. And traction is something that you create. You know, it's who you share it, and you give them enough notice, and so that they can actually put it in their diaries or whatever if they really want to see it, and things like that. And I have a lot of this, like about live, because we're a boarding school. We've got, you know, nearly 1,000 boarders. So do we live stream concerts? You know, children playing instruments. Do we live stream that so that people who are not local can spectate? And It's sort of a big question, and you know, creating. You know,
well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about the difference between live streaming something and creating a highlights video. I was having this conversation with, I think when I was over in Canada about, okay, you're getting an expert to run a webinar or whatever, and you're going to stick that hour-long webinar on the web. Two people are going to watch it all the way through. Whereas if you get them to do the 1 hour webinar and you spend an hour with them as well, getting 10 2-minute clips of really high quality, those 2-minute clips are going to get shed loads of views.
Or certainly a lot more than your original full length footage.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. And if you know how to identify. So I'll tell you what one of the interesting things is. It's about curating the digital content, right? So if you take, I'm doing this at the moment, so my digital leaders at the moment are doing some work for the international admissions people at the school, and they're presenting at a conference in the summer. So they want to create 4 different videos to play during their hour's talk that they're giving at this conference, which will be streamed in Chinese. So half the audience will be Chinese, and it will be instantly translated in headsets. Mm-hmm. And so they want to create these things that they can take away. So it's not just them talking at the front. So they've done it around 4 C's of character and confidence and whatever things that they think this school gives the pupils different to any other, which obviously all schools will probably claim. And so my digital leaders are producing high production quality video for this. And it's a real challenge for them. It's really difficult. We have a very good camera and some really good know-how. On the digital leader team, so we're having a go at doing it, but the question is the traction that you're going to gain from this high quality production, rather than, I mean, the lessons of the internet are not about high quality production, they're about slick production, not high quality, but you know, slick, think vlogs and things like that, and and consumable content. So it's about timing. So when I said, how long do you want these videos to be? They're saying 6 minutes each. And I'm saying, really? Do you know how long a 6 minute video is? So you know how many, you know, who's going to watch it? And that kind of thing. But if you do create these snippets, these short things, they're the things that can hook people in. And essentially the people in the process of doing that make a decision. It's like, I'm gonna watch this for 10 seconds and move along and not watch the rest, or I'm gonna watch the whole thing and that's my fill, or I'm gonna watch the whole thing and I'm gonna go further into a rabbit hole. It's gonna let it take me, my inquiry somewhere else. Maybe watch another one, maybe watch, you know, read, do some reading, look at some websites. And it's all about, it's all about planning and thinking carefully about how you want your digital artifact to interact with your audience. I think that's really important. And this, maybe the base point of that is a photo, and next is a GIF, and next is a, you know, a 30-second video, which is like a TV advert in certain ways. But it's also, do you need high production quality for these things, or do you just need, what you really need is quality content. That's always comes back down to that, in my opinion. You know, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you can have super high 4K definition of something really boring.
That's it. So we would, we like Doug and I, because we are the champions of brevity. we would record just like a 2 minute podcast every week, but we're just not sure where the good shit is. so we just sit here and chat things.
There's a widow on about stuff.
And then hopefully someone out there finds at least 10 seconds of what we say interesting.
Well, I think what we're doing is we're just providing a lot of noise. You know, just in case people who are surveilling us, you know, just get bored and stop trying to find reasons to lock us up. That might change, though, given, and this is my nice little link and segue. So the BBC News reported this week on the fact that in secret, the government has created a draft bill or a draft technical paper around real-time surveillance. As part of the Investigatory Powers Act.
Reaper, yeah.
And the way that this would work initially would be tech companies would be required to remove or enable the removal of encryption from communications, as they would need to be provided in an intelligible form without electronic protection, so basically a backdoor. And it also says, it would have to happen in secret, so the public wouldn't be aware. Simultaneous surveillance could occur in bulk, but be limited to one in every 10,000 users of a given service, a maximum of roughly 900 of BT's 9 million British broadband customers, for instance. And you think, that kind of safeguard in terms of numbers will be the first thing that's just like laughed at and ripped up by the people who are doing the surveilling. Mm-hmm. And it does make me a bit more comfortable the fact that I'm using ISP who are not part of, who will notify me 12 months in advance, they say, if they have to comply with any kind of orders like this.
Yes. Who are they called? Norman something.
It's Andrews and Arnold. So if you just search for AAISP.
I'm sorry to everyone, Norman, Andrews and Arnold. I associated Norman for some reason in my head with the name of Doug's ISP.
So yes, I just feel it's at a time when people are trying to, you know, cut their household budgets because of austerity and Brexit and stuff, and people are responding to, you know, crazy cheap broadband deals, the fact that that then means they're more likely to be surveilled really concerns me.
I think so. That's. I mean, it does make sense. So, like, you know, when Putin is instructing his digital team to find the bad people, he said, "Everyone who uses Tor, go find them." You know what I mean? And so, people using evasive tools, like possibly your ISP, and like possibly things like Signal, or even indeed WhatsApp, with its claimed encryption,
Oh, WhatsApp are now encrypting their iCloud backups for anyone who uses iOS.
All right, okay, interesting. I just want to say while we're on, I use WhatsApp quite a lot, talking to people in different countries around the world, and it's very helpful while I was away in Thailand and India as well. It's a really well-designed app.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. And so it's feedback. So if you're working on the idea that you're doing instant messaging, so you send a message on WhatsApp, you get a tick in grey to tell you that it's left your device. You get two grey ticks to tell you it's arrived at the recipient's device. You get and those ticks turn blue when the person has actually read the message. Then if you send audio. It does a similar thing, but also tells you that the audio has been played, not just that they've seen that there's an audio, but they've actually played it as well through another little bit of colour change in there. And all of this doesn't change the visuals, the sort of the formatting, the layout of the messages. It just it's just there, and it's very discreet and it's very clean. It's very good, I think.
Signal, which we've talked about before, so let's not go into depth, but they updated their app last week to allow encrypted file transfer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is going to be useful.
It is, isn't it? Because, I mean, as these apps grow, as undoubtedly Signal will, you contacted me on Signal today, and it will do the thing. I use, so if anyone is interested in using Signal, I put it onto my Android phone, and it just replaced my messaging app, and it is my default messaging app now. And for anyone... it just behaves like any messaging app, and for anyone else who uses Signal, I know that we're encrypted. And I trust that encryption because of the nature of the organization.
And I think we've mentioned this before, but it's slightly easier to, so you know when you've used iMessage and then you transfer to a different device or you don't want to use iMessage without contact anymore, it's almost impossible to, like, it's almost an intractable problem, yeah?
Yeah.
With Signal, I've had the issue where I think I installed a new ROM on my phone or something happened, or I wanted to text the person instead of message them on Signal, or the person stopped using Signal or something like that. And all you do in that situation is you change your default text message app back to the original text message app as opposed to Signal, and then everything works fine again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very specific use case, but it's something which I could not solve with iOS because it's like the Fisher Price of... technology. Anyway,
just to say, I have I think, do I have in Signal? I have Signal installed on my computer, as well, so I get notifications. Yeah, so I get notifications. Signal private messages installed on OS X, and it was, so when you send me a message, you get notifications on the computer as well, which is quite nice.
Talking about phones and things like that, one of the things that Laura Hilliger and Brian Mathers have been working on or planning recently. And I'll not spoil the surprise of the metaphor they're using to organize that, because we'll talk about that when they launch it. But they've been talking about privacy and about two-factor authentication and how it's one of those things that you know you should do, but you never get around to doing. Well, two-factor authentication, for those listening, is when you not only put a password in, but you also put some kind of code, which is a one-time password, which arrives on your device. And often the way that it arrives on the device is by sending you a text message. I've actually recently, before this article came out, changed from getting my two-factor authentication password through SMS, mainly because I was moving abroad, going abroad, and I thought that was going to be a hassle. So I took the opportunity of preparing for that trip to use, it was actually Google Authenticator, and I'm thinking maybe Google's as part of my threat model, I need to change that. But basically, to cut long story short, this motherboard article says that because there's this thing called a mobile data network called SS7, there's flaws in it. It means that people can intercept text messages. And a German newspaper last week found that hackers managed to hack into this data network to get the two-factor authentication code and then drain people's bank accounts, which is interesting.
That's not good.
So obviously if you don't use that, if you don't use a text message to do the two-factor authentication, then you're more protected. So what you can use instead is something, I think LastPass have got Authenticator, Google is the most widely implemented authenticator, but you can go into your settings in whatever app you're using for two-factor authentication, and you can use an app. And what it does is it joins your account with this authenticator, and then it just keeps rotating cryptographically different passcodes, which then expire every 60 seconds or something like that. Then you type in that. So even if you haven't got a mobile phone signal, hence, you know, when I was in Canada, I could just use my Authenticator app on my device and just type that in instead.
So getting a separate app. So I use an Authenticator app for my banking, which is their app.
Yep.
And I have to type stuff in there, which is a bit annoying, but it's good because it seems secure. That's all straightforward. But that's quite interesting, and it's a very sensible thing. So that will sound possibly to a lot of people like overkill, do you think?
So we were talking earlier before we started recording about Linux and about getting used to it and all that kind of stuff. And I've whinged on this podcast about my Linux laptop, and sometimes I just want to punch it, and sometimes I think it's the best thing ever. And it's one of those things where you adapt to a workflow. And so I believe in life in general that you should make decisions and then stick to the decision that you've made. I try not to come to decisions lightly. I try to weigh up the evidence and stuff. And once I've decided something, I'm going to do it. So I still have cold showers every morning, and that's because of a decision I made a long time ago. And some mornings it is horrendous. I've decided I'm the type of person who's going to do these kinds of things. Yeah. So one of the things I decided was I am going to try and be as secure as possible, even if the government isn't out to get me, because I think it's a good thing to do. Because if you think about these things properly, then, you know, we're all one error, one misplaced tweet, whatever, from being on someone's threat model. So I just thought it was a worthwhile thing to do. And it seems like this motherboard article kind of backs that up.
Yeah, no, it does seem that way. And I think it's quite interesting. When Cal Leeming was at our school, who's a hacker that's served time for his sins, a reformed hacker. And he was very clear about email, for example, just being a postcard. And we should stop treating email as though it's private, because if you know what you're doing and you tap into the channels down which the data is passing of that email, you can just intercept it and read it.
Yeah.
And it's not difficult. It's not encrypted. It's not anything, you know.
Hence politicians moving to things like WhatsApp and things so that their emails can't be leaked.
Yeah, completely.
Because again, at the weekend, Macron's emails were leaked just before the press blackout, weren't they?
Yes, they were indeed. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? Is that I'm not in a sensitive situation in my life, and so none of the information that I handle really is of much sensitivity, until of course my job comes into question, possibly. And that's a great stability in my life and security, which I wouldn't want to be threatened. But I'm sure if my employers could see everything I did, they wouldn't think as well as me as they do, possibly.
Yeah, and anything can be spun in different ways.
Exactly, and things can be taken out of context, and things can go wrong. Yeah. You don't know what's going to go wrong until you do the thing. It's important to protect you. So Macron is not thinking anyone's looking out at his emails, because he was a non-running candidate. You know, he was never going to be the president of France. And, here he is. And so, and it is going to be like that for him. And he won't have sat down and thought, I need to be secure, or had a team around him, because he wouldn't have had the finances around him to have a team that would be looking after his security in that way. But as soon as he's hitting a certain headline, and particularly winning the election, particularly that, he is going to be under such crazy scrutiny. But then at least he has a team around him, or will have a team around him that will.
Yeah. But it's interesting times. The article which we kind of previewed before, I mentioned before, was this one here, which is, wow, it's extremely well written, very well researched. It's in The Guardian, and it's called The Great British Brexit Robbery, How Our Democracy Was Hijacked, by Carol Cadwallader. And I don't know, I've scanned this twice as opposed to read in lots and lots of depth, but the main point is that the company Cambridge Analytica that's been in the news, just how that came to be the focus and the thing which ties together, you know, the Trump campaign and Brexit and Russia and Assange and WikiLeaks and Nigel Farage and all that kind of stuff. And the main point that I got out of it was that the electoral laws that we have about spending are so old fashioned that we're in unprecedented times. So just to read this bit here, it says, so this person who's done, Martin Moore, who's director of the Centre for Study of Communication, Media and Power, King's College, London. Mm-hmm. And he says, I went through all the Leave campaign invoices when the Electoral Commission uploaded them to its site in January. And I kept on discovering all these huge amounts going to a company that not only had I never heard of, but that there was practically nothing at all about on the internet. More money was spent with Aggregate IQ than with any other company in any other campaign in the entire referendum. All I found at that time was a one-page website, and that was it. It was an absolute mystery. Moore contributed to an LSE report published in April that concluded that the UK's electoral laws were weak and helpless in the face of new forms of digital campaigning. Offshore companies, money poured into databases, unfettered third parties, the caps on spending had come off. The laws that had always underpinned Britain's electoral laws were no longer fit for purpose. Laws, the report said, that needed urgently reviewing by Parliament. So then it goes on to talk about micro-targeting of people based on their Facebook data, all this kind of stuff.
So I'm going to do quoting here. It was Facebook that made it possible. It was Facebook that Cambridge Analytica obtained its vast data set in the first place. Earlier, psychologists at Cambridge University harvested Facebook data legally for research purposes and published pioneering peer-reviewed work about determining personality traits, political partisanship, sexuality, and much more from people's Facebook likes. And the SCL, Cambridge Analytica, contracted, I don't know what SCL is, I've been somewhere, contracted a scientist at the university, Dr. Alexander Kogan, to harvest new Facebook data. And he did so by paying people to take a personality quiz, which also allowed not just their own Facebook profiles to be harvested, but those of their friends, a process then allowed by the social network, not now. Mm. Facebook was the source of the psychological insights that enabled Cambridge Analytica to target individuals. It was also the mechanism that enabled them to be delivered on a large scale. So it is Facebook farming is a thing, basically. Yeah. Big thing.
So many things in here. Like, we are in an information war and billionaires are buying up these companies, which are then employed to go to work in the heart of government. That's a very worrying situation. Mm. So, yeah.
Isn't it an interesting idea, right? So, we talk about the filter bubble, the lens and all that kind of thing. And Facebook and the distortion and the confirmation bias. And we talk about how this influences you. And, we both talked about how we go out looking for clean sources of information or opposing sources of information so we don't actually just sit in a pot of confirmation bias. But actually what's going on is it's Facebook that's providing the data that's causing all this crap in our different political systems to happen. Mm-hmm. Isn't that really interesting? It is Facebook that's doing it. It's not Twitter, potentially, but possibly that would be a similar thing if Facebook became less large or more less relatively powerful, and et cetera, et cetera.
Did talk last time about an article on that EU website that talked about it's a different kind of thing on Twitter. What they try and do is destabilize people's opinions. And so there was a flood of, if you remember, Russian-backed tweets, which tried to, when you talk about the Overton window of, what's acceptable in terms of political discourse, it was trying to include the extremes so that, for example, Marine Le Pen seemed a bit more reasonable than, for example, some of these really extreme tweets that were going out. But the fact that we're being manipulated as pretty basic, creatures at the end of the day, mammals, having our psychology manipulated through digital networks is extremely worrying for the future of democracy. And as somebody pointed out, I think on Mastodon this morning, the fact that the most neoliberal economies or societies in the world at the moment are the US and the UK, and the fact that these kinds of things have allowed us to skew right massively. If you look at the kind of way how we've come to this point, it's a massive right turn.
It is completely that. It's quite interesting. So I would argue, so hang on, I'm just going, I've just been clicking through to this to read more about this particular journalist. But what has happened? Have we said this? Let's just tell me if I'm repeating ourselves. By UKIP having its agenda, UKIP's pretty much dissipated now and disappearing. By UKIP having its agenda, and as it did, what it's done is it's forced its issues into mainstream politics, mainstream meaning the dominant political parties. So their policies no longer needed to be represented because they're represented, they were successful in what they did, and it's now part of a wider part, of bigger politics, if you like. And that's a really interesting thing, which is, that is the great British Brexit robbery and the hijacking of our democracy. But I would argue if you trawled back through Tide, we'd have talked about that time ago. We'd have predicted that this was going to happen.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And the weird thing is, the French, who don't live in such a neoliberal society as we do, have managed to elect us kind of a centre-left candidate and reject that kind of nationalist right-wing candidate. While we live in a society, just like in the US, where you've got someone who's pretty left-wing, like, you know, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn and stuff, and then you've got the Conservatives who have just swallowed UKIP's agenda, just in the same way that, yeah, Trump is.
I was talking to a colleague today, and he said the local Conservative candidate for the upcoming elections was on his front door last night, and he talked to him for 20 minutes with one of his babies in his arms. That was my friend, had the baby, not the candidate. And he was really pleased to have that opportunity to talk politics, and he's not a Conservative voter, so he was very pleased to talk to a Conservative representative. And when he talked about Brexit, and this guy's a Spanish teacher and a great traveller, his wife is Colombian, and he was just, how would you expect me to vote for a party that backed Brexit? It's just not okay, you know, or to vote for somebody who did that. And he said, ignore what Theresa May is doing. All she is doing is trying to bring in the UKIP vote into the Tory vote. That's what she's trying to do. So she's actively out there engaging the UKIP voters, who, because there are 52% of the country, or 52% who voted in the referendum. So and then he talked to him about isolating the British economy through Brexit, and the strengths that would go to after a period of discomfort in transition. And I thought that was quite interesting. He had a completely different line on it, and said that's why he voted for Brexit, and this politician did, and just a completely different thing. But what we're seeing in the media is Theresa May courting the UKIP faithful, as it were, or the UKIP peripheral, probably more like. Yeah. Interesting.
Anyway. Crazy world. Right. Lastly, on this thing, there's a thing in TechCrunch, which is, it's a bit of a rambling article, but it's entitled "This Dystopia is Completely Ridiculous," and just basically, as you need to do sometimes, is an article that just points out all the crazy stuff that's happening at the moment. Talks about, you know, I once saw Cory Doctorow talk about ending DRM, that's digital rights management, worldwide in the next decade. Oh, Cory, do you have your work cut out? And it talks about, you know, how that's got even worse. It talks about, you know, the companies which are supposed to be protecting us and be really secure get hacked. It talks about the government, by banning encryption, are effectively banning maths.
Sorry.
And links to loads of things to back up the points. And, you know, the people who have power, like Peter Thiel, who Audrey Waters has been talking about for years in terms of his crazy ideas. Some of the things that he talks about, he's opposed to democracy. He longs for the time when women weren't allowed to vote. Just crazy, crazy world that we live in.
Wow, did you see the thing about passwords? Did we talk about that last time? I don't know if it was out. So passwords password recommendations have been changed by the National Institute for Standards and Technology,
NIST. No, I haven't seen that.
There's a guy here talking about it. He said, right now you have a situation where Teen Vogue is recommending two-factor identity authentication.
Oh, right, yes.
Talking about earlier. And and the National Institute of Standards and Technology cybersecurity framework isn't, which is quite an interesting thing. So you have what are they called? Not commercial magazines, like lifestyle magazines, recommending that you increase your security. Lifestyle podcasts, are we a lifestyle podcast? recommending you up your security and use the best methods available to you at any one time, and be aware of it. So the NIST have just realized that passwords are rubbish. And then we should stop demanding that people update their passwords every whatever. We do it every 12 months here at the school, but in business you might do it every 3 months or even every month. And that it's because if people don't understand passwords, then they don't actually make them into secure things, and therefore they've moved towards two-factor authentication as a recommendation because for reasons we've discussed already.
No, it mentions 23andMe in this particular article. So 23andMe is something we've talked about before, where you take a swab of your cheek and then they go and do some kind of genetic analysis on it, and it tells you.
I've been tempted, but I've never done it.
Yeah, I was tempted as well. Can you imagine making the decision to do that in this day and age in 2017? You just wouldn't, would you?
No.
Crazy.
And it's really tricky. You said 23andMe. It's reminded me of something that I should bring up, an education thing possibly. So there's a TV show on Netflix called 13 Reasons Why. Have you seen that? Heard
about it? Oh, is this the one that deals with like suicide and
yeah, stuff? So you've got a teenage girl, mid-teens, I think, kills herself and leaves 13 hour-long videos, so each one citing a different reason why, blaming a different person or a different set of circumstances. I have not watched it. Interesting. So Amy Burville shared with me a letter that her daughter's school had sent home in Hawaii about warning parents about this TV show that it had gone on. It also, and it's a re- so I had a, I sort of opened it up a little bit and sent it to our pastoral team here.
Like copycat behavior, you mean?
Well, sort of, yes, but it also deals with really really difficult taboo issues. So rape, for example. So the girl is raped and is depicted in the TV show very graphically, and another girl is raped as well, and these are acquaintance rapes, so they're by people that they know. In a teenage world, you know, it's sort of a different thing to people like when you're older, I think, a bit, maybe I'm wrong there, but really interesting thing. And people should, if they're listening and they have a technical digital responsibility within the house, I mean, particularly Netflix is a deal for me because a big boarding school, so Netflix is used a lot here, but it's definitely something people should be aware of and go and have a look.
And what's it called? 13
Reasons Why. But it's a double-sided argument. It's not like panic, fear. This is suicide's going on, and all our children are going to face that question. But it comes from the other side because it's bringing such attention A to suicide, B to the possible reasons why a young person might be mentally dispositioned to take their own life, and also about acquaintance rape as well, where because the scenes are apparently, I've not watched, but I intend to, are very graphic.
Wow.
And obviously deals with those circumstances. So that's definitely an educational shout out right there.
Okay. All right. Okay, we have lots of links in the miscellaneous section. Do any of them stand out in terms of things you want to...
Okay, no, I haven't read through these, so let me have a quick look. I would like no. You choose. I can't choose. Go on, you choose.
Well, while we're talking about kind of videos and things and that thing, I haven't actually watched any of these videos. I just read the article, and I also saw that it was kind of being mentioned on social networks as well. But apparently there's a
I did watch this.
the YouTube thing with the Daddy of Five thing.
Yeah, so a couple, it says Daddy of Five loses custody of two children featured in prank videos. But there's a couple who have apologized on YouTube, so they're YouTubers, and they were using their children as basically props and tools to up their accounts. So the channel has 750,000 followers, and people were actually appalled. But the couple were making approximately $200,000 to $350,000 annually from their channel, according to New York Magazine. It says. And then I don't know how people called shots on them, but eventually people have called shots and said that this is crap parenting behavior, blah 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 blah, and they've stopped it all and done a heartfelt apology on the internet.
Well, just to read out some of the things, I haven't watched the videos themselves, I think they've been pulled, but it says Mike and Heather Martin man the YouTube channel, which features videos of their kids being consistently and cruelly pranked. The Martins have a blended family, i.e., you know, stepdaughters and stepsons and things, and the videos feature all the kids, Mike's son Cody and daughter Emma and Heather's three sons. Mike's son Cody, however, always seemed to bear the brunt of the cruelest pranks. In many of the pranks, the family gangs up on Cody, or the parents are seen screaming obscenities at the child. In one, they destroy some of his electronics while he looks on, crying and red-faced. He never looks like he's having fun with these pranks, probably because there's nothing fun about them. They're abusive as hell. In one bit, the dad encourages the son, says, you know, hitting girls is wrong, but in this case it's your sister, so off you go, and ends up slamming the son's face off a bookcase and, like, face becomes bloody and things. It's just...
Yeah.
I mean, this is the problem with advertising, yeah?
This is the problem with click traction. So when you're, you know, when... Because they're not selling anything. It's quite interesting. So directly... No. So they need to get people to watch their videos, but they don't need to persuade people to do anything. And that's a really interesting thing, because what it means is you essentially have anarchy, you have lawlessness. And what's happened to this family and is that their family dynamics, which are always really, really complicated, I would believe. And like, there's always, you know, in every family, there's a dustbin and who gets more crap than everybody else and that kind of thing. And it's very, very difficult to manage family dynamics and keep them clean and fair, I think. But these poor people have just had their behavior completely and utterly distorted. And whereas obviously they should have called shots on it, and the sorts of things you just described are awful, but their behavior has been pulled and pulled and pulled by this anarchic motivating force, which is get views on YouTube.
And things would get even worse over time, wouldn't they, as people want even more extreme things.
Well, that's a necessary process, isn't it? As it gets worse and worse until you find something new, a new angle in it.
I remember, like, something which has really stuck with me. You know the Lee Child series of books about Jack Reacher?
Uh-huh.
So the one, I think the one before the current one, I think another one's coming out, like, really shocked me at the end. And so for anyone who hasn't read the second-to-last Jack Reacher novel and is going to, like, cover your ears now or whatever, but at the end of that particular novel, they track it down and... cut long story short, there's basically people being put in cages and being killed in interesting ways while being lives interesting, in inverted commas, while for money that people are paying them to do. So, you know, like a journalist being killed by being stabbed with 1,000 biros.
It's sort of Black Mirror stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And you think,
sort of thinking,
well, this is where things go when things have to get more and more and more sensationalist all the time.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a kind of worry, isn't it? So it's a kind of worry that when you it's a bit like adrenaline junkies. You know, they're always seeking the next big thrill, and it's always got to be bigger. And whereas I think as you grow older, as we grow older, as people, as a species, you get I start to try and find sustainable pleasure and contentment in things rather than a new buzz. So the new buzz thing is not something I go seeking. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel it's like, I mean, I have an addictive personality anyway. So I don't want that. Although it can be great fun.
So I just clicked on something which I just saw Mastodon pop up there. It's, Amazon enables free calls and messages on all Echo devices with Alexa calling. It's just been announced. And the top comment on Hacker News is, about the drop-in feature, which lets you make a call to someone without them even answering the phone first. So you have to connect with that person, you have to allow them to do that. And the comment is, I wish that the product person who pushed this as an innovative idea lives a short, brutish, and painful life where he or she dies alone.
That's a bit harsh.
Yeah, well, this is the world we live in. Like, what? Because, oh, man. Yeah. Anyway, anything else which jumps out at you, which is a bit happier?
I'm just going to go and smash my Amazon device before it starts doing stuff I didn't ask it to. You're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you.
Right. Have you seen this?
I think I have, yes. I didn't realize I had, but I think I have.
So this is the oatmeal, which we've featured before, wonderful kind of cartoons. And some people, because it's been so popular over the last few days, have said that, oh, some of the psychology behind this doesn't actually work or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the sentiment behind it is wonderful.
I agree. I think it's interesting. So I like this. So I read it out to somebody else that I was in a car with going to a gig in Cambridge. And and so what is the sentiment behind it, Doug?
Well, it uses some examples. So it's American focused. So some of the examples I didn't really know about or understand. For example, Benjamin Franklin apparently is known as having had wooden teeth, and that turns out to not be true, but instead he had teeth made out of gold, lead, hippopotamus ivory, horse and donkey teeth. And also he had a set of teeth apparently which were made out of slave teeth. And then when you find that out, as somebody who previously thought you had wooden teeth or whatever, how does that make you feel as a patriot, as somebody who's American, like whatever? And it goes on to talk about how in the first thing, when you found out that they weren't made out of wood, they were made out of these other things, you were kind of, oh, that's interesting, right? Well, next time someone brings up, I'm going to correct them. And whereas the second thing, they're made out of slave teeth, is emotionally difficult to process. And so you reject it. And so it talks about that psychological process, and it goes through a few more, like Napoleon Bonaparte wasn't short, he was 5'7", which was taller than the average Frenchman at the time. And I don't know, like what happens when we go into outer space, and Thomas Crapper inventing the toilet, and all this kind of stuff, just some silly things. The Pledge of Allegiance was written by a socialist, and saying things and talking about what your emotional reaction to those things actually is, and how you should respond, and how the whole thing is based on something which he calls the backfire effect, which is the thing which is questioned by other people. But basically that when we are presented with things which don't mesh with our existing beliefs, we find ways of rejecting them. So as I've mentioned on this podcast before, I wouldn't call this a backfire effect. I'd call this our web of beliefs, and how some of them are closer to the center of the web and some of them are further away. So for example, if you told me that somewhere I'd never visited was actually slightly different from the way that I'd conceptualized it, I'd go, oh, okay. Whereas if you try to say that the Eiffel Tower or the Big Ben was actually a hologram, I'd be like, no, because I've seen it, and then kind of engage in an argument with you.
So if someone said to you something like Newcastle United are in the first division, you'd say that can't be possible. They're too good a football team to, do you know what I mean? It'd just be like a shocker.
They must be promoted to the Premier League while my team's been relegated. Thanks, Di. Thanks for that.
No, so I thought this. So I'll tell you the context in which I read this out, so maybe that's of interest.
Okay.
So a teacher, a similar sort of a senior teacher, similar position to what I'm in. So not leadership team, but not, you know, between leadership team, middle management, whole school responsibilities and that kind of thing. And so we were sitting in the car, and we were discussing meetings and the interesting sort of dynamics that happen in meetings. And I'm not particularly, sometimes like I'm really good in a meeting and other times I'm not. And when I'm not is when, and it's essentially, I can read that through what's in this post or what this, the sentiment that this post is trying to say of kind of, which is, it's like fight or don't fight, whether you're having a defensive reaction to something that somebody's saying. And So the example that this my friend gave, my colleague gave, is that if you that he'd suggested something and put a paper together and put it on the table and said, I think this would be good to do to whatever our curriculum or something, and it was just somebody asked him a question and he gave a sort of slightly flippant response, but an unthought through response, and then this person just squashed his paper and it was never seen again. 18 months later, another meeting, same person suggests exactly the same thing that he had suggested. and that often happens. I've had that experience before, and I'm never quite sure whether somebody's being deliberately intrusive or deliberately trying to irk me, or whether the person is over time realizing that what I've said was just before its time and it needed that or whatever, you know. And anyway, So my reflection on that is what I often need, which is why many meetings are run so bad, but if you can't be prepared for them. But what I often need is time just to sit with the information kind of swimming around me and just not to sit there and grapple with it at the table with the interested parties right there, but just to sit by myself and just walk with it a little bit and just feel the information and think about it. And before I can come up with what I really think is an important point about it or my thoughts about it, you know. And so in a meeting situation, it's not so good. And I thought possibly this is an explanation of why. It's because when my defensive, I have an emotional reaction to somebody just saying something in a room or at a meeting table, and I have to let those emotions disappear. And so I can sit with it without those emotions and wonder why it is that they're saying this thing. Whether I'm wrong or right or whether we're missing something or whatever, you know.
Yeah, people need to kind of come to the inside themselves, don't they?
Yeah, and it is.
It's the difference between, you know, when you're trying to affect change within an organization, the difference between you knowing for a fact that there's a better way of doing something or that someone's doing something wrong and you telling them that, and if they then change their opinion or if they change their practice, then, hey, I was right and you were wrong, as opposed to, I think the example I gave to someone the other day was Seth Godin's blog. So, for example, you know that Seth Godin every so often is going to post about certain things. So you go, you know, I think you'd really enjoy that blog. Why don't you sign up for that? And then they sign up for it or whatever. And lo and behold, 3 days later, Seth Godin posts about the exact thing that you wanted to convince them about. And then they've come through with the insight, as opposed to you telling them about the thing. I think it's always best to do these things indirectly.
Yeah, and no, it's interesting. So I remember a lesson I learned as a young parent. And so at this point, my stepson was, I think, 6 or 8 or something. And my eldest one, and he we were playing tennis, and I don't know tennis very much, but I do know certain things. So I was trying to show him some certain things that I've been taught by somebody when I was a teenager, so years and years before. And he was like, directly in front of me and others in the family as we were playing tennis, he was like, he couldn't look more disinterested if he'd tried. but then the next time we played tennis, and so he refused to like even practice the things I said, or he tried it once, it didn't work, blah, blah, blah. But the next time he played tennis, there he was doing the things, and he kind of processed them in his mind and worked out how to do them.
Oh, we were talking about this when I was saying how difficult it is to teach your own child to swim.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And it's like, it's that thing. It's
the emotions get in the way.
Yeah. So it's like indirect is good, but that's not necessarily the point. Direct often just doesn't work. Your expectation for direct.
I have this. So I'm amazed that my wife uses Google Calendar and Telegram and stuff, because it's taken me ages to persuade her to kind of move things and change things. I think she's more likely to listen to me now, but certainly, I think I remember it took me about 3 years to get on Google Calendar, because again, it was, this is the right thing for you to do, and therefore, if you do this, I will be right. And it took a while for that to then wear off enough for her to make the decision for herself.
Yes, exactly. And to go and have a look at it and sort of see, okay, I can see how this makes sense. I find that really hard in the stuff that I do. So a lot of people expect me just to come and say, oh no, use your computer like this and in your life will be revolutionized. And I'm like, no, that's not really how it works. And you kind of have to get a feel for the individual and how they're doing their work and then what's going to make sense to them, so that they can go and find the things. And why don't you try this or have a look in this direction? And you're trying to sort of, it gets frustrating at times because you want to push them a little faster and kind of say, you know, you have to go and experience this in your working life, not see it in mine. because you will find reasons, you know, people always find reasons to doubt what it is that I'm saying or the value of what it is that I'm saying or whatever it might be. And it's not that I have the right answer exactly for that person either. That's the thing. It's like,
no, exactly.
don't do what I do. Don't have a look at this. I think you might like this. There's some other teachers out there like this. And it's a little bit, it looks like it's going to solve some of your problems with whatever it might be. So that's one of the things that I've learned in my many years of doing the job that I do is the power of suggestion, not direction.
Yeah, absolutely. We've probably got time for another one, maybe two. Anything else you want to dig into?
Boom, 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 boom. Here's how I use Slack to manage my work day.
So this is somebody who works for Slack, who then says basically they use it for everything. As you'd imagine, they dog food it, to use the jargon. And she uses bots and app integrations and all this kind of stuff. I think it's a she. I assumed it was. So it talks about right from 6:30 a.m. my little human alarm clocks sound off. it talks about news feeds, all that kind of stuff. And then it talks about Slack bots and it talks about all those kinds of things that's been added in. So ordering things from bed using a Slack bot. Things which have updated them. So, for example, another integration from Google says that 5 contacts have been added and you can look at them. New reports that have been created. Slackbot says that someone's requesting a meeting with them. What's best, you know, because it integrates with their Google Calendar. Is it going to be this meeting time in this particular room or this meeting time in this particular room? Then it talks about the things that you've ordered. So literally everything's going through Slack because of the integrations they've got. And I guess it's how you can have everything in your organization going through Slack as opposed to through email.
Oh, so they're making a pitch. That's quite interesting. One of the first things my head, who's now in post for 5 terms, so a year and a half or so, one of the first things she said to me was, you're not going to tell me email's dead, are you? And I looked at her and thought, oh, I could, but I won't. But it's interesting. So when your organization is immersed in Slack, it looks like there's lots of little things that are interesting here to do.
Well, the thing is, like, obviously Slack is a tech company, so everybody who's doing this, it's not just the fact that you can do this stuff, it's the fact that people understand what's going on. So last time we talked, we were talking about somebody who said, you know, I turned all of my coworkers into bots and nobody even noticed. It's like just having that understanding of what's going on when there's a bot doing things and their limitations and what they can do and, you know, how... what the integrations are doing, etc. Today, I was on the Slack channel that you're part of, the We Are Open one.
Mm-hmm.
There's channels which are only open to the 4 members of the co-op. Yeah, and one of the things in that members channel is an integration with Trello. So Laura went in and moved and updated loads of Trello cards. So all of a sudden, I'm getting tick, 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 tick. Like Laura has updated this thing and there's a million things going on. And of course that can be really distracting. So I think it's almost a separate form of literacy. Like it's a domain specific understanding of what's going on. It's actually Slack and its ilk are a new type of app that we haven't really had before.
Yes. Yes.
Because before we've always had, separate things, like here's email, here's my calendar. Whereas Slack, the assumption is that you wouldn't really need to ever leave the app if you've got everything configured correctly.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, but it's the question is how much configuration needs to be done by the individual. It's a bit like back to the Fitbit with my dad. Sometimes I have to set it up to really get what's going on with it.
So I've never actually seen a non-tech company use anything like Slack well.
No, I'm just trying to think what it would be like if we tried to move people across. So WhatsApp Messenger works quite well, and it's a piece of software that people pick up without requiring much instruction, although it can be a bit fiddly at times, I think. And I think Slack would be pretty difficult. I mean, these people work at Slack, so obviously they're invested in exploring its dark corners. But I certainly think communications would be a lot better if you could do this. I use like apps like Slack or to talk to my pupils, kind of thing. Get around the safeguarding stuff by having another teacher in there as well.
Right. Yeah. We'll see. I mean, Slack will be discovered by formal education in 2025, but we'll see. One thing I did want to mention just quickly was Audrey Waters' post from now quite a while back called Unannotated, which led to some interesting posts, and I felt that I should write a blog post about it. I did feel weird writing a blog post about someone else's decision, but it was being discussed so much by people in my networks, I felt like I had to write something to see what I thought about it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fine. I don't have a problem with that. With your writing about it, I'm just looking. So she's taken off the possibility to annotate her posts using inline annotation tools.
Yeah, so there's a couple of services, at least a couple of services, one called Hypothesis, one called Genius, and they allow you, in the same way, you know, they can have a bookmark. You can basically add an annotation layer to the web. Google had something called SideWiki a while back that allowed you to do something similar. And the upside is you can see what other people have said about it and what people have commented, a bit like on Medium and stuff like that. The downside is that if you are often the subject of misogyny, hatred, trollish kind of behavior, then guess what? This is another place that people can effectively scroll all over your site. Now, Audrey had already, a few years ago, removed the comments section from her site. And I eventually could understand. At first, I couldn't understand why you'd do that. It felt like a form of censorship. But then I understood that actually it's her site and other people can comment on their website and link back. And why should she have to deal with that crap? Again, when she announced that she was blocking Hypothesis and Genius, I thought, why? And then I realized it's the same thing again. I don't have to deal with this crap because I'm a, you know, mid-30s white male who doesn't have to deal with all the stuff that she has to deal with, and also doesn't stick my neck out as far as she does. So not quite as brave. But so I wrote this thing just to kind of say, hey. So I called it. So it turns out that you can do whatever you like on your own website, and that's true, isn't it? You know, the fact that it's hers and it. It's her domain and she's paid for it and it's her site and she can do whatever she wants.
Damn right.
But then some people said, well, hang on a minute. She says that she's an open educator and all this kind of stuff. How does that square with that? Well, she's not stopping anybody from under a Creative Commons license copying what's on her website and then annotating it elsewhere. It's just as Mike Caulfield said, who also wrote about this. It's like she's got the master document. And she's just not allowing people to graffiti and annotate and write in the margins of that.
Yeah, I don't see. I think it's interesting. I mean, we've talked about this when we've talked about her blog before and comments being taken off. Is that if you want to discuss a post and you want to have a conversation about it, you can take that out into other forum to do that. So Twitter, for example, and have the conversation on Twitter. And Twitter, and then the author of that post can ignore you or not accordingly, and other people can join in. But the point is that the conversation has some real-time flow to it. And when you have these things, these edits, the highlights, whatever, using these tools on your website, especially if you're getting a lot of negative press in some ways or a lot of unsubstantiated critique, it's pretty dodge, possibly.
Mm. Well, I mean, I didn't just write the post to agree. I did try and add something new, which was, well, let's think about other precedents here. So remember when Pokemon Go was a big thing? Okay. People were getting hacked off by the fact that their real life location, their house, people were randomly pulling up onto their drive to fight Pokemon battles, which seemed like they shouldn't be allowed to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Google Street View in Germany, I think they've had to pull it a couple of times because of privacy laws in terms of people standing on their own land and being photographed, you know? And then there's a text file for anyone who's ever created a website will know this. It's called robots.txt. And in that text file, you specify who can and who can't crawl your website. So, for example, if you didn't want Google to index your site, you could put that as a specific format in robots.txt. And legally, I think, or they certainly should comply with that. Interestingly, the Internet Archive have stopped complying with that because they've found that too often people let their domains expire, then people who are like domain squatters will, or like trying to get the Google juice, will buy that website, that domain, and then put a robots.txt file on saying basically delete all history. Which means that to comply with that, Internet Archive then has to delete all of its archive things. So they've started actually ignoring robots.txt. But it's an interesting kind of liminal space where some things are okay and some things aren't. And I do admire Audrey for taking that particular stance and, you know, taking the flak from the community and saying, well, hey, it's my website, and do whatever I want.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of quite interesting. I mean, I imagine there'll be a lot of complex and different reactions to it, and because you just expect that to happen. But I don't think, I think, you know, everyone has a right to do what they want with their own things. So yeah. That's it.
Okay, I think we should probably call it a day there. What are you up to this week, Di?
Marking, moderating coursework has to be sent away. Marks have to be away by the 15th of May. So that's what I will be doing.
Do you break up for summer?
You don't want to know. So 1st of July, 2nd of July, something like that.
Okay.
And yes. And I'm going to be investigating the fact that you can now have Google Keep down the side of your Google Doc. Did you know that?
Yeah, nice integration there.
I'm looking if the integration is actually worthwhile or not. I was using it with someone earlier, and okay. It's a quick way of getting a drawing into a Google document. Just wondering if it keeps associated with the document or how it works. I'm curious. Yep. Have a look at that. What are you doing?
Well, as I kind of predicted, IMS Global Learning Consortium, who took over the Open Badges standard from Mozilla, have massively cut back and suspended any kind of community work. So there's a call tomorrow to figure out what's going on there, because like the community is what makes Open Badges awesome. So I'm going to attend that. Thursday is my grandmother's funeral. Friday, I'm just doing some more work and writing and things. And then Sunday and Monday, I'm doing another couple of Quality Mountain Days in the Lake District. I haven't exactly worked out my route yet, but my wife pointed out that Sundays and Mondays are less interfere with the kind of kids' activities and make things a bit easier on her. So Sunday and Monday next week. And then, yeah, before we talk again, and it might interfere with recording this podcast, I'm going to be going to the Thinking Digital Conference, which is at the Sage in Gateshead, and something I always enjoy.
Okay, that should be good.
Yeah.
Cool.
Good. Okay, well, take care until next week. And thank you very much for everyone listening. And sorry that podcasts have been a bit sporadic recently, but I think our travelling is mostly done now. So we're back to the weekly routine, hopefully.
Yes, should be good. Should be good. Absolutely. Look forward to talking to you next week. Goodbye, everyone.
Cheers.
Watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a darker bay, wasting time.